Greetings from the Bluegrass State.
That's Kentucky, if y'all didn't know.
We want to tell you about the hottest new podcast on the block, Coffee and Cases. If you fancy yourself an at-home detective,
if you find yourself yelling at the TV during that new true crime documentary,
then you, my friend, are a certified sleuthhound.
Just like us.
On Coffee and Cases podcast, you'll hear about the missing, the murdered, and the unsolved.
But the cases you've rarely, if ever, heard about.
All from the perspective of two teacher friends, rule followers, and self-proclaimed scaredy cats. Join me, Allison,
and me, Maggie,
each week as we take on cases that are often overlooked but are screaming for justice.
Finally, a true crime podcast where you don't have to monitor the foul language.
Coffee and Cases is a true crime guilty pleasure that you don't actually have to feel guilty about. Check out Coffee and Cases every Thursday for a new episode on your favorite podcasting app.
That was a podcast promotion for Coffee and Cases podcast. Join Allison and Maggie each week as they dive into the unknown and the unsolved. If you're a fan, make sure to rate and review them on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts.
At which time I lifted up his jacket and shirt and began to do a body sweep to try to find where the blood was coming from.
It was Christmas time of 2019 when a group of old high school friends gathered at a local bar in Nashville, Tennessee. As they all got caught up on their new endeavors, a man approached a woman in the group and began to pay her some unwanted attention. Unable to take no for an answer, an altercation ensued between the man and the group, which then spilled outside. In a matter of just seconds, a light-hearted gathering among friends transformed into a gruesome nightmare. Battlegrounds Academy is a small, independent K-12 college preparatory school in Franklin. Two graduates of the school were 22-year-old Clayton Bethard and 21-year-old Paul Trapini. The two had hit it off immediately, bonding over their shared love for sport. Clayton had been a quarterback, while Paul played basketball. Clayton truly had football in his blood. He was the brother of CJ Bethard, the quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. He was also the grandson of Bobby Bethard, the NFL general manager, who was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2018. Clayton's father, Casey, was a country music songwriter, and he and his wife, Susan, also had another son, Tucker, who was a country music singer as well. To say that talent flowed through the family would be an understatement. And Clayton was just getting ready to make his mark on the world. After graduation, Clayton enrolled at Long Island University, where he was majoring in sports management and playing as the starting quarterback. Much like his brother, he had dreams and ambitions of playing in the NFL. Clayton was described by his family as a big and soft-hearted human who had an undeniable love for the Lord. As his mother and father said, he had his family's and teammates' backs even to a fault. He loved children and he couldn't wait to be a father himself one day. Clayton also had a massive soft spot for those in need, and he loved being a big brother to his little sister, and he completely idolized his older brothers. It was a very tight-knit family, and the siblings all had gotten on more like friends than siblings. As for Paul, after he graduated from Battleground Academy, he enrolled in Rhodes College. He was majoring in political science and he had plans to go to law school after graduating. According to those who loved Paul, he was goofy, but in a really good way. While it's extremely cliché, his friends all said that they would always depend on him to make them laugh. On Saturday, the 20th of December 2019, Clayton and Paul met up with a group of old high school friends at Dogwood Bar and Grill, located in the area of Division Street and 19th Avenue in Nashville. One of the friends that they met up with was A.J. Bethurum, who was now a University of Tennessee Knoxville student. Clayton, Paul and A.J. had all become good friends at Battlegrounds Academy. A.J. describes the friendship that the group shared.
It was awesome. I mean, a lot of us had known each other since kindergarten. We had a big group that stayed at BGA all the way through. And then, you know, everyone who was added to that class throughout our time there, I mean, we just welcomed them with open arms, and we were, you know, super close, super tight. I met Clay in eighth grade, just a godly individual. All around, just funny guy, fun to be around, a true athlete. I mean, the guy had it all. He was awesome. Paul is probably the funniest person I've ever met. He had this kind of laughable, not kind of class clown aspect to him where he would just make everyone laugh. But when you needed him and, you know, you needed to talk about something, he would be the most genuine, honest, you know, caring person he could be with you.
It was Christmas break, and it was the perfect time for the catch-up. There were a lot of new beginnings for the group of old friends, college graduations, grad schools, and even new jobs. It can often be hard as you get older to stay in contact with your school friends. So the group of BGA graduates, well, they liked to get together any chance they had. One of the group, Wilson McCulloch, recollects the night.
So what I remember from being in Dogwood was that we were, you know, I remember going there and it was kind of like an unplanned reunion almost. You know, there was a lot of people that I hadn't seen in a long time. So my memory was just kind of going around, you know, catching up with different people and having a good time talking about whatever it may be, catching up. Just like everyone was kind of cheerful, happy. Good to see you. Good to see you. What are you up to? You know.
Another member of the group, Phoebe Fauver, described the night, stating, "We basically spent the whole night together. We just wanted to be together and have a good time. There was a long table we were at for a while. The group of friends were drinking and having a good time together when Emma Yoder, who was part of their friend circle, was approached by a man. He asked if he could buy her a drink, to which she politely declined."
He approached me right before we were leaving the bar. He came over and put his arm around me and I think whispered something in my ear again, and then I just turned away.
Shortly thereafter, the same man approached Emma again. This time he attempted to dance with her and placed his hands on her hips. Emma really wasn't interested. The man's actions began to make her feel uncomfortable. Her friend Thoby recollected, "It just kept happening. He was relentless. We just kept grabbing hands and moving away to the point where we just left." The group of friends could see the situation unfolding, and one of them, Sam Folks, came up to Emma and the unknown man and said that he was her boyfriend and put his arm around her. The ruse was an attempt to get the man to back off, because clearly he wouldn't take no for an answer. It was around closing time, and the man and the group of friends left the bar, along with all of the other guests. As they were walking out, the man once again approached Emma. He put his arm around her and whispered in her ear. Once outside, the man continued to hassle Emma, and the group of friends asked him to leave her alone. Bad-mouthing quickly escalated into a physical fight, when the unknown man punched Sam multiple times in the face. Some other members of the group of friends jumped in, and the fight moved over the street. Since it was kicking out time, there were a lot of people milling around in the street, waiting to catch an Uber or a taxi home. The instigator of the argument punched one of the group of friends multiple times in the face. Another one of the group of friends managed to get the man in a headlock and punch him back. The man managed to break free, and he pushed Emma to the ground. By this point, two friends of the unidentified man had gotten involved. AJ was just coming out of the bar as the altercation had turned physical. He was trying to book an Uber when he saw that Emma had been pushed to the ground. He then saw his friend, Toby, being shoved to the ground. He ran over to try and defend his friends and de-escalate the situation. Clayton pushed the man to the ground. And just seconds later, AJ felt a sharp pain to the side of his face. His vision went black as he fell to the ground. Blinded by whatever had just struck him in the face, he heard somebody scream that Clayton had just been stabbed. After AJ had fallen to the floor, the man lunged at Clayton and then lunged at Paul. Struggling to see, AJ pulled himself off the ground and ran over to Clayton. He was laying on the street with blood seeping from his shirt. As AJ lowered himself down to try and assist his friend, one of the bouncers shouted, "Bro, you got stabbed too. You're bleeding a lot." It then dawned on AJ that he had been stabbed in the face and arm. The physical fight erupted and then ended within just 60 seconds. But in those 60 seconds, three people were stabbed by the unknown man. Both Clayton and Paul were bleeding profusely from stab wounds to their stomach. Jacob Asher, the head of security at the bar, had watched the entire attack unfold. He ran over to try and administer aid to the stabbing victims. By this point, Paul was fading in and out of consciousness.
So, once I got over there, there was a crowd of people around him, obviously his friends, trying to, you know, wake him up and stand him up and stuff like that. I physically removed a couple people in a non-malicious way, obviously. I went down. I asked him if he could tell me his name. He gave no response. I began examining him to the best of my ability. I seen, obviously, copious amounts of blood, at which time I lifted up his jacket and shirt and began to do a body sweep to try to find where the blood was coming from. At which point, I found about an inch and a half laceration right here around his diaphragm area, at which time I began to apply pressure. I instructed another security guard to go get me some towels. I continued to talk to Paul, told him, "Hey man, it's going to be okay, I'm here with you." I instructed one of his friends to hold his head and keep talking to him. During this whole process, he began to vomit a little bit, so I had everybody like roll him on his side, kinda.
Jacob applied pressure, put him on his side, and tried to elevate his legs to circulate the blood.
The only response that I got was that he had looked at me. You know, me and him were looking eye to eye. You know, very shallow breaths, no verbal response whatsoever. There was no real, like he you know, didn't grab up and reach for me or anything like that. He was just there, kind of lifeless. I don't know the medical term, but whenever somebody passes away, they give one last breath, and it's more of a groan rather than a breath. And whenever I was looking at Paul, trying to talk to him, you know, try to keep his, you know, spirits up, he let out that groan, at which time I felt that he had passed away.
By this point, an ambulance had already been called and people had gathered around Clayton, Paul, and AJ, trying to keep them awake and apply pressure to their injuries. Both Clayton and Paul were in a far more severe situation than AJ. Neither of them were responding, and both of them were struggling for breath. David Beals, another member of the group of friends, later recollected, "The most I could get out of Paul was a little groan. He couldn't keep his head up. I was trying to keep him awake and their lives open. I wanted them to fight for their lives as hard as they could." Clayton, Paul, and AJ were rushed to Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Upon arrival, Clayton and Paul were pronounced dead. They had both been stabbed in the heart. Clayton had died from a 2.5-inch stab wound to his chest that punctured the heart. Paul had died from a nearly 2-inch stab wound to his chest and a nearly 2-inch stab wound to his back, which punctured his heart. As for AJ, he had been stabbed in the left eye and arm, but thankfully, he would make a full recovery. Following his discharge from the hospital, he said to WVLT News, "All my thoughts and prayers go to the families of my friends who passed away." Investigators announced to the public that they were searching for suspects or witnesses to the fatal fight. Just the following day, they released some surveillance footage from inside the bar and outside the bar. The surveillance images had captured three men and a woman, and investigators announced that they were wanting to identify these four people and bring them in for questioning. Two of the men, one who was wearing a Nike sweatshirt and the other who was wearing a puffy jacket, could be seen standing outside the front of the bar. The other man and woman were standing in front of a booth inside the bar. Eventually, the footage showed the four persons of interest joining one another at the booth. It was evident that the four people knew one another. In a statement, investigators said, "The fatal stabbings appear to have resulted from an argument over a woman that began inside the Dogwood bar and then turned physical when the parties went outside." As the images were released in the media, tributes for Clayton and Paul came flooding in. The 49ers said in a statement, "The 49ers family was shocked and saddened to learn of the tragedy involving CJ Beathard's younger brother, Clayton. We extend our heartfelt sympathies to CJ and the entire Beathard family as they cope with the unthinkable loss of a loved one. CJ has travelled home to join his family, knowing he has the full support of our organisation as they grieve the passing of Clayton." Clayton's family also released a statement which read in part, "He lived a full life except for the chance of being the incredible father I know he would have been. He loved kids, underdogs, and the less fortunate. His little sister was his world, and his love and pride for his older brothers was off the charts. He will be missed. That is an understatement. Nobody's light shined like his when he smiled." A statement was also released by Paul's family, which read in part, "Paul committed himself fully to a life of purpose, and he already knew that his purpose was to be present for the people he loved. We are so thankful for the countless prayers, messages, and stories we have received from so many." Almost as soon as the surveillance images were released to the public, all four of the persons of interest were identified. Investigators would hold another press conference, updating the public on the investigation. They said that based on information gathered, they had identified a main suspect in the murders. It was 23-year-old Michael Mosley, and a $42,500 reward was put out for anybody who would assist in his apprehension. This money was raised by a group of Nashville business owners, including Dogwood Bar and Grill, and sports journalist and radio host Clay Travis. The state also added $12,000 to the fund. Mosley had quite a disturbing criminal record, which showed a pattern of violence and assault. In 2014, he was arrested for attempted aggravated burglary. He pleaded guilty and received a 1-year sentence. In May of 2015, he was indicted on a stabbing which had taken place on Colt Drive after he got into an argument with a woman. In this case, the woman, who was a relative of Mosley, was attempting to leave with her 14-month-old son. Mosley chased after the woman, and he stabbed her once in the stomach. He was convicted in 2017 for the stabbing, and he received concurrent 3.5-year sentences. Before he was convicted and sentenced, however, he had found himself in even more trouble. In December of 2015, he was charged with misdemeanor assault for squirting urine from a shampoo bottle on an employee at a jail in Davidson County. He was also arrested on multiple counts of aggravated robbery. He had carried out 3 robberies at gunpoint in Edmondson Pike. Mosley would also be convicted of the robberies in February of 2018, and he received two concurrent six-year sentences. Then in 2018, Mosley was charged with two separate assaults. On the 30th of October 2018, Mosley had confronted his cousin, Chandra Warren, at her home in Charlotte Pike. The confrontation was over something that Chandra had written about Mosley on Facebook. During the confrontation, Mosley became aggressive, and he grabbed Chandra and dragged her from her chair by the hair. He proceeded to slam Chandra's head into a dresser before they struggled on the floor. He then slammed her head onto the floor. Mosley was charged with a misdemeanor of domestic assault with bodily injury. Just 2 months after this incident, Mosley entered the Walmart located on Charlotte Pike. He approached a woman identified as Molly Baker, charged at her, and struck her in the face, knocking her to the ground. Once on the ground, the attack continued. Mosley punched and kicked Molly, and he dragged her across the floor by her hair. Molly suffered an injury to her eye and a small puncture wound below her eye. When Mosley had fled from the Walmart, he dropped a set of keys, and it was speculated that these keys had been used to inflict the injuries on Molly. Mosley was charged with felony aggravated assault. His most recent offence had occurred in March of 2019, when he was involved in a jail riot in Cheatham County. He was among six inmates that were charged with instigating the riot. At the time, the jail had been overpopulated, and the riot escalated by inmates who were attempting to settle a bet. At the time of the stabbing, Mosley was actually free on $5,000 bond in relation to the attack in Walmart. With Mosley's name and picture out in the media, the public were asked to keep an eye out for him, get in contact with police if they spotted him or knew of his whereabouts. His last known residence was in Pegram. Investigators said that Mosley was a danger to Middle Tennessee, and he needed to be apprehended as soon as possible. They even appealed to Mosley himself, asking him to turn himself in peacefully. The weekend came and went, and Mosley was still at large. Early Tuesday morning, he was added to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation's Most Wanted list. On Christmas morning, as families across the world were gathering to spend the festive period together, the SWAT team and police surrounded a vacant home on Petway Road in Ashland City. Investigators had received some tips that Mosley could have been staked out at the vacant home. The vacant home was currently for sale, and Mosley had the door code because he had previously worked there as a handyman. One of the responding officers was Lieutenant Ken Miller, who later said, "We were pretty sure he already committed two homicides, so we didn't know how desperate he's going to be." Investigators also didn't know whether Mosley was going to be alone. As Lieutenant Miller said, "We knew he had to have help to be hiding out. We know people who were supplying him." Investigators had obtained a search warrant for the vacant home after a new cell phone that Mosley had purchased after the murders pinged to its location. They circled the home and shouted for Mosley to come out. Around 10 to 15 minutes after surrounding the home, Mosley came out with his hands above his head and surrendered. He was booked into jail on two counts of criminal homicide and one count of attempted criminal homicide. He was ordered to be held without bond on the two murder charges, but as for the attempted murder charge, a $5,000 bond was set. As the families were informed of the arrest, Clayton's father Casey said, "We are thankful that he is off the streets. We are sad because two incredible young men are missed. The only thing that holds us together is trusting God. We are in awe of all the good we have already seen him working in and through this tragedy." Clayton's brother CJ released a statement on Instagram. It was the first time he had spoken about his brother's murder publicly. It read in part, "What happened is absolutely awful and has been and will continue to be the hardest thing my family and I have gone through. But I can find some peace knowing that he is at peace in heaven right now. And I know without a doubt God will bring a whole bunch of good out of this. He described his brother as the most loyal person he had ever known in his life, and said that he was always so proud of him. Clayton and Paul's families now had the daunting task of making arrangements for their funerals. On the 27th of December, a visitation for Paul was held at Williamson Memorial Funeral Home in Franklin. The day afterwards, his funeral was held at historic Franklin Presbyterian Church, where Paul and his family were members. Following Paul's funeral, he was buried in the Garden of Angels in the Williamson Memorial Gardens. In his memory, donations were made to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, or Memphis Area Legal Services. Clayton's funeral was held at 3 p.m. the same day, at Grace Chapel in Franklin. In Clayton's memory, donations were made to Franktown Open Hearts. A candlelight vigil was also held outside the courtroom in Franklin, and it was held by the school community of Battlegrounds Academy. Shortly thereafter, Mosley would retain defence attorney Justin Johnson. Defence Johnson would grant an interview to the Tennessean, and he made it abundantly clear what their defence was going to be. He claimed that Mosley was simply acting in self-defence when he stabbed three people. He said that he had reviewed what limited evidence was so far available, and said it showed that Mosley was defending himself. He said that Mosley was truly remorseful and regretful of what had happened, and to everyone's family, but said that he wanted everybody to wait and see the evidence as it comes out. It was quite obvious that this was going to be the route the defence team took. Typically in altercations that result in somebody losing their life, the defendant will claim self-defence. There's really no other defence to work with in such cases, so it wasn't much of a surprise when Defence Johnson announced this. In early January, a preliminary hearing was scheduled. During the hearing, Defence Johnson said that his client had acted in self-defence after being approached by a group of men who were throwing punches. He said that the victims had approached Mosley first, stating, "They're the ones that, and I hate to say it, brought it on themselves." Prosecutor Jan Norman strongly refuted this. She said that Mosley had been the one to throw the first punch, and this was captured on surveillance footage. She also said that he was the one there with the weapon, telling the judge, "Mr. Mosley started this fight that ended in two people being murdered. He stabs him through the front of the heart, and then it goes all the way through, and it doesn't stop there. This is Mr. Mosley. Mr. Mosley brought this on these victims." Judge Melissa Blackburn determined that there was enough evidence against Mosley for the case to proceed, and she sent it to the grand jury for consideration. In June, the grand jury indicted Mosley on two counts of first-degree murder and one count of attempted first-degree murder. The trial was scheduled for March of 2022. Before then, Mosley needed to be sentenced for the earlier attack at Walmart on Molly Baker. He had already been convicted of the attack. It couldn't be refuted because surveillance footage at Walmart had captured the entire attack unfold. As it transpired, Mosley and Molly had known one another. She and her husband Daniel were actually awaiting trial after they were charged with shooting and killing Mosley's stepbrother in 2016. Well, Mosley didn't want to wait for trial, so he took matters into his own hands. During his trial for that attack, the prosecution had played a jail phone call from him, in which he said, "Yeah, like how are you going to tell me I criminally attempted to commit aggravated assault when I didn't attempt to do nothing? I did what I did. It's on video. I beat this bitch up." For the attack in Walmart, Mosley was ultimately sentenced to 12 years in prison. Then on the 28th of March 2022, his murder trial began. During opening statements, Assistant District Attorney Jan Norman said to the jury that Mosley had escalated a fist fight with the introduction of a knife.
"And you'll see that he swings at Mr. Mosley. Mr. Mosley swings back. And you'll see Clay after he swings. He swings at him and he stops. And you'll see Clay with his arms at his side, that he stops. He is not going after him. You'll see Paul Trepini that he's walking towards because now his friend Clay has been swung at. Something's going on. But again, you'll see how he's standing with his arms down. And you'll see Clay Bethard as he's standing there, that there's clearly some words being said. And then you'll see AJ Bethram, that he walks up, because again, these are all of their friends. And you'll see AJ walk up to the situation. Now, AJ is tall, but you'll actually get to see him in court and you'll see him in the surveillance video. He is a thin person. He is not imposing in any way.
She detailed how Mosley got up, took a stance where he's readying himself.
And you will see him as he aims at Clay Bethard, and he actually leaps and lunges around JC Harper, around her, and stabs Clay Bethard in the chest, directly in the chest. You will see in that video that no one else has any contact with Clay Bethard. It is Mr. Mosley that strikes him in the chest.
District Attorney Norman then states, "You'll see him bend over and collapse on the sidewalk. You will see Mosley calmly walk away after fixing his hair, leaving Clay and Paul to bleed to death on the sidewalk. Knowing what he has done to them, he will calmly walk away." Mosley's defense team, on the other hand, were sticking to the self-defense claim. Defense attorney Ken McQuillan stated, "This tragedy began as a joke.
You see Wilson McCullough and Mr. Mosley huddled together head to head watching Emma Yoder. Time after time, McCullough motions towards Emma, encouraging Mr. Mosley to approach her or to hit on her, as people say. Mosley one time does start to approach Emma, loses his nerve, does a 180 and goes back."
He said that when Mosley hit on Clayton and Paul's friend in the bar, he had been encouraged to do so by his friends. He said that at one point, Mosley was put in a headlock and soccer punched. As for the fact that Mosley was the one to throw the first punch, he claimed that he was baited into punching Sam. On the first day of the trial, the jury would see video and photographic evidence taken from outside the bar. It showed Mosley and a member of the Battle Group Academy friend circle, Sam Folks, arguing before Mosley repeatedly punches Sam in the face. Emma Yoder, who had been hit on by Mosley at the bar, was one of the first witnesses to testify. She too had been a graduate of Battle Group Academy, and she had known Clayton and Paul for years. She became emotional as she spoke about her late friends. She said that Clayton had the kindest heart she had ever known. And as for Paul, she said that he was the kind of guy that everybody wanted to be around all of the time. The topic then turned to the night in question. Emma detailed how Mosley had hit on her multiple times, and seemingly, he wouldn't take no for an answer. She described how the argument then spilled onto the street, where it turned violent. As per the surveillance footage, after Mosley hit Sam several times, another member of the group circle got him into a headlock and punched him. Now, according to Mosley's defense team, this was evidence of self-defense. Yet Mosley had been the one to throw the first punch. Emma was asked by prosecutor Norman, "Do you wish that whoever that is holding Michael Mosley had held on to him a little bit longer?" Emma replied, "Yes, ma'am." To which prosecutor Norman then asked, "If he had been restrained at that moment, would your friends have died?" Emma responded, "No." After Mosley was placed into a headlock, he managed to break free and step back. He could be seen on the footage fixing his hair and then running back towards the crowd, which consisted of the Battle Group Academy friend circle, and also some of Mosley's friends, who had by now gotten involved as well. At one point, Clayton pushed Mosley to the ground. When he got back up, he was armed with a knife. He lunged directly at Clayton, stabbing him once in the chest, and then lunged at Paul, stabbing him twice. The surveillance footage then shows Clayton and Paul staggering to the other side of the road before they both collapsed. Nobody in the group reported seeing a weapon, but within seconds, three people ended up stabbed. Following the stabbing, Mosley and two of his friends calmly walked away from the chaos and left the scene in a car. One of the friends, Daniel Sevilla, would be ordered to testify. He admitted that he had been involved in the fight, which had spilled outside. Despite the fact that surveillance footage showed that Mosley had been the one to throw the first punch, he said that the BGA group of friends had started an altercation with Mosley.
Then Mr. Mosley got kind of crowded between a car and a bunch of people, and then a fight broke out and it was time to run for your life.
Okay. And you said a fight broke out. Mm-hmm. Did you participate in that fight?
Yeah. Pushing and shoving and getting hit.
He testified that he wasn't aware that anybody had been stabbed, and only came to realize the severity of the situation the following day, when his image from the bar surveillance footage was shared in the media, and he was identified as a person of interest. He said that after seeing the footage, he called Mosley, a woman, and another man that they were with that night. He then shut down all of his social media profiles. A couple of days later, he voluntarily spoke with the investigators about what had happened at the bar. The other male friend, Sergio Alvarado, had been subpoenaed to testify during the trial. He had shown up to court, but he defied the subpoena. He refused to come into the courtroom and said that he feared for his safety if he were to testify. Sergio, whose street name was Scrappy, was a known MS-13 gang leader. The reason that Mosley and Sergio were at the bar that night was to sell drugs, although Mosley was not facing any drugs charges in relation to that. The female friend of Mosley would also testify. JC Harbour told the jury that she had tried to defuse the tense situation between Mosley and the group of friends. She said that while they were outside, she heard either Mosley or Daniel say that they were going to fight the group of BGA graduates. She said, "It seemed to me every time I separated a situation, another escalated." AJ, who had also been stabbed, would take the jury through the attack. AJ had since fully lost all vision in his left eye.
Went to the defense and tried to break it up or defend my friends. I confronted an individual, and then after confronting that individual, I was stabbed multiple times.
Where were you stabbed?
I was stabbed right under my left eye and also in my left arm.
And when you say under your left eye, was it just the skin under your eye, or where exactly were you stabbed?
No, I was stabbed. That was the entry point. The knife actually went up through the front of my eye, through the back of my eye, and actually through the posterior wall of my orbit. And I actually had an air pocket in my brain because it went through my skull.
He spoke about the physical and emotional pain he had experienced in the aftermath of the attack, which killed two of his best friends. After 3 days of evidence, the prosecution and the defense rested. During closing arguments, Prosecutor Norman said, "It was Mr. Mosley's desire to take Clay Bethard's life, and he did. Mr. Mosley intended to take Paul Trapani from his friends and family. He intended to take his life. He intended to kill AJ Baruthum, but he did feel at that." She said that Mosley had robbed Clayton and Paul's family of them, adding, "These men were going places. These men were going to be incredible." During the defense's closing arguments, they once again tried to claim that the murder was self-defense. Defense attorney Quillen said, "I would suggest that when a man angrily walks towards you and points at you, that is a threat." He said that Mosley was much smaller than the victims, which would have caused him to fear for his life. In his final statement, he asked the jury to consider whether a lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter was more appropriate. Prosecutor Norman rebutted this and read the law surrounding self-defense. She said that the argument did not apply in this case and questioned why the defense had not actually mentioned anything about the law in their closing argument. She stated, "Self-defense is only available when and to the degree the defendant reasonably believed that force was immediately necessary to protect against the alleged victim's use of unlawful force. The defendant began this fight. He chose everything about it. There's no way that any person, no matter how tall or short you are, would have any reasonable belief that this group of people was out to get him." Today's sponsor on Morbidology is BetterHelp. Did you know that stress shows up in all kinds of ways? For example, headaches, teeth grinding, digestive issues, sleep problems, and even doom scrolling. Well, BetterHelp is here for you. I know for me personally, sometimes it's better to chat with somebody about my problems, such as sleep issues that leave me feeling tired, stressed out, and unable to focus. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offer video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anybody if you don't want to. BetterHelp is much more affordable than in-person therapy. Give it a try and see if online therapy can help lower your stress. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Morbidology listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/morbidology. That's betterhelp.com/morbidology. The jury were then sent off to deliberate the fate of Michael Mosley. The crux of the case would be whether they believed the defense's claims of self-defense or not. They returned after just 1 hour of deliberation.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Michael David Mosley, count one, first-degree murder upon the alleged victim, Clayton King Bethard, guilty of first-degree murder.
They found Michael Mosley guilty on 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of attempted first-degree murder. The sentencing phase was to follow. Mosley was already serving a 12-year sentence for the attack on the woman in Walmart. He was now facing a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. The prosecution was seeking consecutive life sentences, meaning that Mosley would not have a shot at parole until he had served 51 years. Prosecutor Norman stated, "Society needs to be protected against Michael Mosley." AJ had written a victim impact statement, which was read aloud by Prosecutor Norman. He detailed the impact that the physical attack had on his life.
"Living with the physical disability of only having vision in one eye is far from the greatest consequence resultant of the defendant's actions on 21 December 2019. Having 2 working eyes is purely a luxury. One eye will get the job done quite well, and I am determined not to let this physical disadvantage keep me from reaching my full potential in this life. A positive mindset and a personal reflection on perspective make these physical pains manageable. The emotional impact this process has had on my life is more notable. The unimaginable pain of losing 2 of your closest friends at the same time is something that I cannot put into words. The multiple times in the months that followed that I would physically get out my phone to call or text one of them, to only be hit in the face by a wave of renewed sadness, were tough. Soon after the tragedy, the mother of one of my friends involved had pictures framed for us of the last picture we all took together. It's one of my most cherished possessions, but that picture sat hidden in a drawer for over 1.5 years because I simply couldn't look at it without being overcome with emotion. Being together with friends and going through this process together has been helpful to all. But to this day, every time we get together, it always feels incomplete without Paul and Clay."
Paul's sister, Caroline Mitchell, also provided a statement. She stood before the microphone and said, "My parents are hurting every second of every minute. of every day. The pain is not only ours to carry. The grief is so layered and so widespread. Like a ripple in the water, the reach of time seems limitless. We will never have the light-hearted holiday season that so many enjoy. Paul's promising life was taken from him on December 21st, 2019. She rounded up her statement by reading from Paul's journal.
In 2019, in his journal, Paul wrote down the things he was thankful for. A healthy family, a wonderful girlfriend, Annie, a life he had little to worry about, with little to worry about underlined, a great school, great friends, and amazing parents. In Paul's own words, this is what was taken from him. Our pain is great, but it is nothing compared to what Paul lost.
The final statement came from Clayton's father, Casey. He spoke about how his faith had helped him get through the past couple of difficult years. He stated, "In God's kingdom, nothing goes wasted. Clay is safe. He's not lost. Neither is Paul, but they are in fact swallowed up by life. The Bible says that, and that's the hope that covers us every day. We're going to see Clay again soon, and that is the hope we carry. That is what has saved us." Casey then turned to Mosley and told him that God loves him. Before the sentence was handed down, Mosley was given the opportunity to speak.
"First and foremost, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry your family and friends lost their lives because of my actions. And I'm sorry for the insurmountable pain and suffering you went through as a result. I say that with sincerity, not because it's what's expected of me. Those words truly reflect what's in my heart. Not once during this process, my arrest, incarceration, court dates, lawyers, trial, was your pain ever lost on me. During trial, the DAs were quite convincing in having everyone believe that I intended for this to happen and that I knew what I was going to do that night. It was difficult keeping my composure while listening to this because in my heart I knew it wasn't the truth. I never intended to take these young men's lives and to put you through so much pain and suffering. I made an impulsive decision that I've regretted every day since and will for the rest of my life. And again, I'm sorry, and I pray y'all find peace."
Michael Mosley was given two consecutive life sentences. This was to be followed by a further 40-year sentence that was based on guidelines in state law. What started out as a fun-filled night for a group of young adults wanting to catch up quickly transformed into a bloody nightmare with the introduction of a knife. For years, Michael Mosley had displayed just how violent and unpredictable he could be. In the end, his fate was sealed by surveillance footage, which clearly showed that he had been the instigator in the fight, and he had been the one to bring along a knife. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my lovely new Patreon supporters, Amy, Laura, and Victoria. The support on Patreon seriously helps the show out so, so much. In exchange for your support, you get ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes, a handwritten thank you card, and merch. If you'd like to join me on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. And you can join for as little as $1 a month and cancel any time. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. But please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Conning the Con. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week. Something's
creeping, don't follow it down. 24 hours ago, I found out the person that I've been dating for the last 6 months is a con man.
That is my sister Emma. Andrew Tonks's lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual. Coming up in this series.
And that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris. And this is my story, Conning the Con.